Let's get started. I think it's a couple minutes early, but that's fine. My goal for this workshop is to talk about the differences between disobedience and disability and kind of diagnosing those things. And in the following workshop, we're going to focus primarily on dealing with disabilities. And I'm hoping to have a lot of feedback and discussion about that. So in that class in particular, if you have a situation that you're looking for help with, if you come with that, or maybe talk about it today, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it today as well. So I'm hoping we get time for all that. So first of all, I started teaching in 2001 in Belize. My first year of teaching, and before school started, the school board met with the teachers, two of us, and the school board, used the term loosely, as one person, but he was the chairman and the trust and the advisory board and the treasurer and everything. He informed us that he didn't really care for any of these inventive, creative, new punishment methods. Basically, he said he believed in using the rod for punishment. That's what he wants you to do for school. And my co-teacher, a slightly diffident fella, he got a little pale and said, what do you mean by the rod? And I was like, where did you grow up? I mean, I knew what that meant. And so, you know, in some ways this was not bad advice. I was a different culture, and the school board wanted us to deal with disobedience right away and just take care of it. While it was small, he wanted us to be the adult in the room, not try to make friends with our students, not try to be their buddy. It worked reasonably well for me. I followed his advice. He recommended a three strikes policy, in other words, they would have three chances, and if the third time they misbehaved, they would be punished. And I had a list of rules, and it was just normal teacher stuff, sort of. It worked reasonably well. I had fairly good order, hardly any punishments. My students were used to harsh punishment at home, so what I doled out was fairly gentle, mild, and pretty good camaraderie in my class. And I enjoyed my time. It did not actually work very well for my co-teacher for various reasons. Worked all right for me for the most part, except for one student. Looking back, this student had severe learning disabilities. He was impulsive. He would blurt out inappropriate comments all the time, jaw-droppingly inappropriate comments. And he was also a runner. He would run away from school when he saw you approaching. He would just run away when things got tough, and he was wild. He was really wild. One day, I remember in particular, he ran away from school when he knew he had a punishment coming. And I was shocked. That was the first time he had run away from school. He came back to school later to get something, armed with a machete. And I just ignored him, and he eventually went away. The school board felt like what he needed was a firm hand. If I would just be there, stand up there, and be gruff, say, "Hey, none of that," why, they were pretty sure he would shape up. And there was some truth to that. The school board came in and substituted one day. And I just no problems with him at all, one day or 2 days. But it didn't last to treat him that way. Eventually, the board did conclude that Ricardo needed more than discipline. He needed some incentive. And so we had a meeting with Ricardo and his parents. The chairman told Ricardo that if he could behave in school, and he would obey Mr. John and be a good student, that we would buy him a brand new bike, which this boy, he longed for a new bike. Do you think that worked?
For a while, maybe.
Yeah. A few days. It didn't work. Even this great incentive, he could not do it. You know, this is a little bit of a difficult topic to tackle, because not because it's impossible to discern between disobedience and disability, but because we often hear what we want to hear sometimes. And I'm not even critical of us for this, because it's so often born out of a genuine concern for a child that we love. We're often grasping at ways to fix problems, and it's difficult for us to be objective. You know, as teachers, we want all of our students to reach their full potential. We want to see them succeed in their work, their schoolwork, on the playground, socially with their peers. We want to see them have success. And how do we determine if a child is being disobedient or has a disability, not just has a disability? I want to be clear. It may be harder than you think to tell the difference. There are some basic guidelines that we use in relating to our students that we're going to get to here. So I do want to hear your questions and comments. Just pretty much any time, raise your hand, say, what did you mean by that, or explain this, and I won't be able to sometimes, but I'll add, there's so much wisdom here that we'll find an answer, I'm sure. So what does disobedience look like, first of all? Well, what would you say? What's something that comes to mind, disobedience? I mean, I have a list there, but you can come up with something else, too.
Going outside the norm or going outside the expected?
Okay. Outside the expected, outside the norm. Perfect. Yeah. And there's kind of norms in our cultures. Whatever your culture is, whatever your school culture is, there's some norms there. But good. One of the things that people taught me at some point, and I've read and I didn't actually understand it when I was growing up, although I was taught it, but I understand it as an adult, is that being slow to respond is disobedience. It's the old story about the boy who's sitting down, but he's standing up inside, that old thing. Old saying, delayed obedience is disobedience. Moving as slowly as possible as you can get by with when you're told to go do something, that's typical disobedience. Shows up this high right here, when they're that tall. So that's disobedience. Often, bad body language. What does bad body language look like? Can you demonstrate that for me? Anybody? All of you, just demonstrate bad body language. There you go. That's it. Perfect. Yeah. Some of you don't know how. That's all right. That's fine. It could be chin down or chin up. All kinds of things. And what I see in teenagers in particular is just a listlessness. Just kind of saggy. I'm just not going to get involved. Really, really typical form of disobedience. And as you become OCD about some of these things, you'll try to work on their posture, deal with it that way. Kind of works, sort of, not necessarily. And just non-compliance. If I ask you to do something, you just kind of sit there. We'll think about it. Yeah. Back talk. That's another one. And sulking. What does sulking look like? You know what? We had a lovely dog that just died. And this dog had personality like... It was such an expressive dog. And this dog hated when we went away on a trip. And it also hated when we would kick him. So in the wintertime, he's allowed to come into the back room. He's a huge dog. We had 120 pounds or something. Big old dog. But he would be allowed to come in the back room and lie there. And he was really good about that. But Rose, my wife, would get tired of him in there, and she'd kick him out. And he would pout. It was astonishing. I have pictures of him sitting on the porch, sitting upright with his head down and his tail he just would not look at you. He would not acknowledge you. He's just pouting. I just did not know that a dog would do that. I've seen it in teenagers a lot where there's just no, you ask him a question. No. So that is a form of disobedience, I believe. A sulking, muttering and grumbling, dishonesty. No, I don't remember. You know, I don't remember that I did that. I don't remember that I broke that thing. No. Probably not. Probably wasn't me. Dishonesty, complaining, inattention, just not paying attention, just not focused, and irresponsible. Wasn't my fault. And being a poor sport on and off the playground. Symptoms of disability that we encounter. So those were disobedient symptoms. And these that I have listed are ones that I thought through. I actually did this class, I think a year ago or so, or a year or two ago. So I went back and reused most of these notes. But if you look at this list, being unable to cope with life, like getting stressed, what does that mean actually, being unable to cope with life? You're depressed, but just acting out, and often acting out in ways that show up on this other list, in your posture, inattention. No episodic memory. I wrote down that label because I thought it looked nice, and I looked at it this morning and said, what did I mean with that? But there are episodes that happen, and they're kind of big events where they maybe have a tantrum and make a great big loud noisy fuss, like Ramona Quimby would say. I'm going to make a big loud noisy fuss. Okay, and then they forgot about it. The next day, they don't remember that at all. That really does happen. Overreacting to being hurt on the playground, and how many of you had experience with this? Okay, now I've seen children without a disability kind of do this to some extent, but it is very, very noticeable in children with FAS, I think, is one of the ones that I've really, really seen it, where maybe got tagged on the back, just a tiny bit hard maybe, and clutches his knee, and jumps around, and you're, what happened? I fell down and hurt my, well, actually, it didn't even fall down. You're just overreacting. And it makes sense in their mind. They're not really, I think, they're not really lying. They're not really being dishonest. But they're dealing with something. Does that make sense? Hope that makes sense. It was so interesting. So I had a student who had this, was diagnosed with being, I think, ADHD. And his parents went to the doctor, and the doctor told him a few things. One of the things they told him was that, the doctor told the parents, is that if he screams and runs away, he's not hurt. Don't worry about it. Because if he's really hurt, he won't run. That's their idea. And so what was interesting is this student comes to school, and he grows up, and he's in ninth grade. And he's getting over his problems a little bit. But we've got another one in our school who's a runner, a screamer and a runner. And this boy told me that in confidence. You know, if he screams and runs away, he's not hurt. Well, it's just really interesting because I remembered when he was doing that. But he did grow out of that. So, good sign there. Screaming without inhibitions. Terry Hayden talks about this in particular. How many of you are familiar with her books? Tori Hayden, I guess. Yeah, she talks about this in, I think, Beautiful Child, about a child who will just scream without inhibition, just when they're hurt or upset, to just scream. And normally children, by the time they reach age 6, have stopped doing that. Like, it's typical for a 2-year-old to just get mad and just scream. That was another thing that I have definitely seen, making the same mistake over and over. Now, about the screaming issue, though, understand that children scream often when they're hurt. Like, if they cut themselves, they'll scream with fear over the sight of blood. That's different. Something bleeds, and they're not really even hurt that bad, but it bleeds a lot. A head wound or something like that. Yeah, that's not really what I'm talking about. That they're screaming because they're scared. I'm talking about uninhibited screaming when they're not really hurt. Making the same mistake over and over, just the same mistake. Going back to the episodic memory, not having that. And obsessive behavior. You all know what OCD is? OCD, it's... what does it stand for now? Obsessive compulsive disorder, that's right. And where you just have to do that. So there's different writers I know that have that. A.J. Jacobs is one of them. You know who A.J. Jacobs is? Some of you? Yeah, he is obsessive compulsive. He has to turn the radio off on a. Why does that matter? I have no idea. But things like that. He'll be driving along. There, turns it off. And there's things like that, or obsessive hand washing. It's all kinds of things like that that are actually not really normal. They're not terrible. It's just interesting signs. Easily distracted. That also means, just easily distracted. Just say that. And uncomfortable with surprises. They do not do well with surprise events. And can sometimes, and here's this is tricky, can sometimes perform better than expected with incentives. Why is that tricky? Because, can you tell me why that's tricky? Yes?
Because then we expect them to do it all the time.
Yeah, we'll just work harder and you can do it all the time. I'm not actually sure why they can do it sometimes. Any ideas on that?
I think sometimes the cost is actually so great they can't sustain it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the mental ability it takes to do a math lesson at that level.
Mm-hmm.
They can't repeat it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good answer. Really good answer. We talk about, performing at 100%. Well, we can't perform at 100%. You know, none of us ever do 100%. Ever. And the people who tell you need to do 110%, they are, you don't do 100%. I don't know if you know that, but you can't actually do 110%. You can do about 93%, and that's it. Because when you've done 100%, you're dead. So you don't ever get there. I don't know of anybody that has, anyway. Okay. So if we think about most of the vulnerabilities of childhood, I think that what we see is that they're amplified in a child with disabilities. Pretty much all just amplified. For example, children and adults both tend to forget things. We just do. Walk into a room. What's that called? A doorway, gateway memory or something. Or you walk into a room and when you pass the doorway, you forget why you're in the room. And that happens. That's just normal. But it's amplified with children with disabilities. especially, I would say, with children with FAS, and in my experience. Now, one of the things that I've learned is that, too, told me by another teacher, I actually remembered 20 years ago, maybe not quite 20 years ago, is that children of all ages or students of all ages would rather appear bad than stupid. Okay? So if we took Trennis, can I use you for an illustration here? Yeah. If I told you to please come up front here and I would like to do something to demonstrate how you do not know how to do something, what would you do? You would be bad. Yeah. You would just sit there and say, no. Well, that's how we are. We do not want to appear stupid in front of other people. And no matter their age, no matter their social standing, whatever, they're always going to be that way. You know, it's interesting. While I was getting ready for this talk, I had a dream about going to a teacher meeting. And I remembered this dream. And in this dream, the inspector had a timed test on punctuation. And I know punctuation, or at least I did in the dream. But his test was terribly complicated, and it was poorly designed, involving identifying some poorly dyed little bits of toothpick that represented punctuation marks, and you had to cut some of them and mark them with a pencil, and then glue them on a piece of paper. And it was a time test, and time was running out, and the instructor was on a power trip, kind of glaring at us. And I got confused and frustrated, and I didn't get half done. And the instructor had a pleased smirk because we were all struggling. And he assured us that if we couldn't finish it, we'd have to do it again tomorrow. And when the beeper went off, I slammed my board down and I said, "This is a stupid test!" And what made me mad was the stupid test made me feel stupid. And I woke up and remembered that dream, and I thought, that is so much what somebody with a certain type of learning disability faces every day in school. It doesn't make sense to them. We expect it to make sense. Maybe we even use a timer for them and tell them they can do it again tomorrow, you know. So, I don't know, I guess that was a vision. So what's defined as a disability? It's something that's out of the ordinary for us. So what kind of disabilities have you all encountered? How many of you have dealt with dyslexia in your classroom of some kind? Probably all of you, if you're honest. Okay, what about FAS? So dyslexia. We're before we move on here, you all kind of know what that is. So let's see. Dolores, you gave me a really good definition for it. What was it?
When someone's reading ability is not equal to their intelligence.
Okay. I think I might have read that at some point, but I didn't realize it was quite that broad. So very interesting. Okay, how about FAS, or fetal alcohol syndrome? This is... Okay, a few, or not as many. So thankfully that's not as prevalent. That is a syndrome that happens when the child is affected by the mother drinking alcohol while the baby is developing. That one is very sad to me because it's really difficult to deal with. And as I understand that, if it's caught early enough, there's some ways to work with it. But essentially what happens is there's brain irregularities that form. And the way that's continually been explained to me, it seems too simple, is that there's holes in the brain. So think of the brain as this block of memory. And inside that block, there's actually missing places. So memories that should be there, they don't stick in there. So certain types of things in particular. I had one student in particular that I think would have had very high intelligence likely, but had this disability, and he would work extremely hard. He would struggle. He would try to come up with the answer, and we would drill and work hard with him, and he would be trying so hard, and it just wasn't there. Just simply, the answer was not there. Okay. Some children have vision and hearing difficulties too that go along with FAS. So also vision problems are something that we can face. How many of you have faced that? So a child that has, okay, so more than I would have thought. Double vision. I went to school with somebody who had double vision, really, really struggled to read. How many of you have students or had students that are colorblind? This is not a huge disability. You might not know it, actually.
I'm partly, so.
You're partly colorblind. Okay, what colors?
I don't know if it's one color in particular, but anytime it gets sort of dark. And
oh, really?
It's good lighting, I'll start calling green things brown.
Okay.
Green or whatever.
Okay. So one of my sons is colorblind for, I think, two colors. And it's red and, what's the other one? So red and brown, he'll just call. So he was trying to fry hamburger the other day. And he was like, is this stuff done? And it was completely red yet, you know. No, it's not done. Interesting that he's the most artistic of all of my children. He learned to draw. But instead of using paints or colored pencils, he wants to do black and white. He's an amazing artist. Brag about my own children, but I'll show you some pictures. So that's something to check. Also, just for your information, your children, if they're underperforming, just check and see if their eyes are bad. Run into that way more often than we should have, even with our own children. One who's struggling and realize, oh, that's why he's up at the board writing things down. He actually can't read the board from his seat. So that happens for sure. And another teacher told me recently of a boy who just did not obey instructions very well. And he actually realized after some discipline issues that he didn't hear him. He was not hearing. Which is very unfortunate. Okay, what about ADD or ADHD? Dealt with that some, okay? And what about RAD, R-A-D? It's called Reactive Attachment Disorder, some of you have. So this is one that has come, we've started to learn more about it recently, and this one is really, really tricky, but it is caused by an insufficient connection to the parents, essentially, I would say. Is that a good way to say it? So when a child is developing, when they're born, and then they're held by their mother and their father, there's a very special and very important bond that's developed. It's developed physically, through the physical action of holding this child. So for the mother, it's while she's feeding him, for the father, while he's taken care of, this bonding experience is very, very important. So what happens when a child is adopted, sometimes, you know, obviously that bond is cut there, and it's somebody else that takes that place. Now, there are children that are adopted that do not have RAD. I'm absolutely not saying that every adopted child has RAD, no. But the ones that are successful, and I think there's a genetic disposition to have this as well. So, but the ones that are successful are the parents who take that child, and they do form that bond. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's
right. Adoption is wonderful, too. I'm not casting. It's wonderful. But what that develops then into is these children have, as they grow up, if that bond does not form at some point, they are really insecure about relationships, essentially. And they tend to become very controlling and manipulative, and I just was astonished at the things that I found out about this when I started reading it. I've had a number of students that had it, and none of them, we didn't diagnose them at all until they were older. And it is difficult to deal with. Just say it's difficult. Autism is another, and there's a whole range of spectrum there. Also, Asperger's syndrome, which is kind of similar there, is something that we can deal with. Do you all understand autism and Asperger's syndrome? I want to say that the biggest thing that you notice with that, or the biggest effect of that in a child's life, I think, is overstimulation. So a way to think about it is this. If you are talking with somebody else, we'll just use Trennis here again. He's a wonderful example here. But you're talking to Ryan, and you're conversing, and everybody is kind of talking here in the room. And three rows back, somebody is talking, and they're just talking, and they say Trennis in a sentence. So even though you're talking here, you will probably pick up your name right there. For one thing, it's not a real common name like John or something. But you're going to pick that up even though you weren't listening for it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, so that's what overstimulation does, where everything is like that for you, right? And that's why it's so distracting, okay? So if you think about it, if you focus anywhere here in this room, you're going to see, there's a light, and there's a white wall, or maybe it's a gray wall, or it's a white wall. And out the window, there's some sighting, and I see the sighting is screwed. Oh, it looks like it's... there's some wainscot there, and there's some mold out there on the. And you just see all those things if you focus. But for somebody that has autism or suffers from this overstimulation, they're not able to filter that out and focus. It's like that is always on for them, all those things, right? And also the noise, so they'll hear the truck going by, and it's... They can't ignore that. How many of you ever slept close to a railroad tracks? Okay. How many of you have done that for like 2 weeks or something, and you didn't notice the train anymore? Yeah. So somebody with autism cannot do that. They will just, that thing will just wake them up, and they can't shut that thing off. So does that make sense? That's what they deal with. Okay. So for most of us, we can get distracted, but we can still focus through the noise, mostly. There is a syndrome, I forget what it's called, but if you hear somebody that eats very noisily, some people have this thing too where they can't focus. And that is going on. Yeah. Millers are really bad about that. And then, of course, there is another one that is considered to be a disability. It's called ODD. Does anybody know what that is? ODD, odd, or it's ODD. It's not the Garfield comic character either, OD, but it's called oppositional defiance disorder. Basically, this is the fella who, when he's told to do something, he doesn't want to do it. Well, I'm on board with giving people room for disabilities, but this particular one, I think it's just disobedience. I did some research on it. I might be wrong. If you find something different, let me know. But I think that's just, like somebody said, I think I read it in your notes, there's ADAM, which is the disability that we're all born with, the fallen man disease. And of course, there's factors like abuse, dysfunctional home life, That's one of the saddest things that I've dealt with, is a home life where mom and dad don't love each other, frankly. It's chaos for a child growing up. That's supposed to be their security. Okay? When they don't have that, they come to school and act out and look for security there, and they're manipulative there. That's a real thing to deal with. Okay. Now, I don't think it's wise. Any questions or clarification, comment? Absolutely. Good point. One of my students was a biological child, and with their biological parents, and had RAD. Yes.
But something obviously happened or did not happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the case that I know of. The parents were loving and caring. Actually, in two of the cases I can think of, the parents were really good parents. One of the ones that was, the home life was very dysfunctional. But you all heard that? Sometimes RAD children are not adopted. Okay. But the bond doesn't form for whatever reason. Okay. Now, I don't think it's wise to jump too quickly to a conclusion or make assumptions too early. Many times a child might be just going through a difficult time, a growth spurt or whatever, tough time, testing their boundaries. And I'm not sure how incredibly helpful it is. I feel like it's a mistake to feel like we've really accomplished something by really carefully and specifically diagnosing and feel like, now we have the problem. Well, no. We understand the problem, but we haven't fixed anything, right? Maybe we've given reason for more mercy or grace or whatever, but we haven't fixed them. The goal is to educate the child, and educate means to grow up the child, I think. I think that's what the word educate actually means. Okay. So how do we relate to our students? Quick point here before we go on. There always has to be consequences or punishment for disobedience. And this is true no matter the condition of the child. This is a widely held position by secular child psychologists. So this is not just Christians being hard on their children. In the name of, I don't know what, but holy living or whatever. This is, I think there's good science behind this. We are doing our children a disservice not to give them consequences for misbehavior. We're not preparing them for a productive life. Having said that, being fair is not the same thing as being equal. And this is very difficult because children, students have an acute sense of fair. Like if you treat a child differently, they'll notice it. There's a teacher I remember who told his students at the beginning of the year, this year we're going to treat everybody as fairly as possible. Understand that being fair is not the same as being equal. And I will decide what is fair. I tried that a few years. And I had good students, and they were accommodating of my eccentricities a little bit. I actually think that's good advice, okay? If you can do that with your students. I'm not sure how well it works with, like, second graders. They're pretty careful about, you know, four pieces of candy, four students. That's good, but what if there's five pieces? That's a real moral dilemma for them, okay? But this is why black and white, all-encompassing discipline plans tend not to work quite as well if you have students like that. So what should I have done differently with my student from that first year? I should have realized that he would need more reminders than the other students, for one. I can't just depend on him to be accountable all by himself. I'm going to have to talk to him constantly. I'm going to be beside him and say, hey, did you remember that you're supposed to hand this in? Did you remember that, hey, wait, we don't do this at recess right here, remember? Not three strikes, that's not enough for him. I also, if I could go back and do this over, I would make him make restitution when he hurt somebody. When he did something that hurt somebody else's feelings, I would make sure, and he would have to do it to me too. If he said something disrespectful to me, I would make sure that he would do that. And this is not something I learned on my own. This was also something from a parent, working with a parent who, a very wise set of parents, who really jumped on the situation with their child, their son that they loved. And they wanted him to have more grace in school. They also wanted me to be very strict with him. And they wanted me to make sure that if he misbehaves, that he has to make restitution. And it was very effective with him. Okay, and I would also say, work very closely with your parents. They're these precious students. They belong to the parents. And they're in the end responsible for their upbringing. Be very slow to criticize their parenting methods, and if you have a concern, just talk about it to the parents, not to the students. Okay, questions or comments?
I have a question.
Yes.
So last year I had a second grader who he's sort of hyperactive. I'm not sure they actually diagnosed him with anything, but he's hyperactive.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the type of child that will come in the morning, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll say, good morning, as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately has a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. I love hearing his stories.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm wondering is, am I responding right? Like, so he'll say a story, and then I'll, like, want to ask him questions. I can maybe ask one or two questions, but he's almost immediately always talking. And then I'll ask him a question or two, he'll answer, and then he's out the door.
Mm-hmm. Do y'all hear that? Let's see, Lydia, yeah. You have any advice for her on that?
How did the rest of your teaching go with him, with your classes?
He was fairly easily distracted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And his parents actually did take him somewhere. They're doing the therapy with the mental,
brain balance or something.
Yeah.
Brain balance?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
And it did seem to help his concentration.
Okay. Hmm.
And he did not read very well when he came into second mm-hmm. grade, and so we did the Sounds Plus with him, and he's doing second grade over again.
Okay.
Hoping to be able to do all the normal things.
Sure. So you have a good attitude about school, mostly? Or?
Mostly.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're doing to me sounds good. I'm not sure. What do the rest of you think on that? So your question is about whether you should let him, like, tell you the story and then run off.
To it, right?
Oh yeah, I think just listening. A lot of times they want to know if you care enough to listen. Is a really big thing. So I would say that's a good response right there. Just listen to him. And this is one of the things that I face too. It's a symptom that is alarming to us. And that is a child who tells whoppers. That's a lie, right? Are they allowed to tell lies? Like great big stories. But I have had a student with FAS, ADHD. I actually can't remember what he was diagnosed with. And he had very, very low episodic memory. And I actually think came to realize he doesn't understand that he's telling an untruth. When he got older, then he did realize that. I felt I was very uncomfortable with that because I do not want my students to feel like something that's a sin, which liars, you know where they go. I do not want to let them continue to do something like that. Does that make sense? But I came to believe that that was not necessarily a lie. Maybe I was being too gentle and soft and too much gentle parenting thing going on, but I hope that makes sense. I should have probably had the recorder off for that statement. Okay. So I have some questions here quickly, and then we're going to close. And so if you could think about these questions and come back with some ideas. And I should have written them down here. So if you can't remember them, ask me again. But what if the parents don't believe their child has a disability? Then what? What do you do? What if the parenting methods for this child, you as a teacher, believe are too harsh? What do you do then? Dad says, just spank him. He's just misbehaving. Then what? What if the parenting is too soft? He'll never really amount to anything anyway. What do you do then? What if the parents and the school board disagree about the child? Who has the authority to decide? I'm not sure that you guys are, maybe you have some wisdom for me on that. But that is a real scenario that happens. What about a student with a disability that has learned to manipulate her parents and the teacher? And how much should the disability change the situation? Okay, I'm going to stop there, I think. Thank you for your attention and participation, and hopefully we'll have a lot of time for discussion next time. I don't know if we can maybe sit, you know, circle a little bit next time. I have no idea if there's a possibility we could do that. But where we could all hear and you could share the things that you're facing or have faced, I would love to hear, just kind of have a little bit of a forum on this. Thank you.
Is your coffee cold?
It is cold.